We went to one of those bookshops that's basically just a house that has been jammed full of as many bookshelves as it is physically possible to get in there, regardless entirely of health and safety standards, as far as I could tell.
If only we could take our love of reading to a new level.
Well, I've always wanted to start a book club.
Book club!
For
masochists and other deviants.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club for Masochists, where we read and discuss all the genres and types of literature, regardless of our actual interest in them.
Every month, we read books from a new, randomly picked genre. Then on the podcast, we discuss our reading choices, experiences, opinions, appeal factors, and other related topics as friends and library workers.
This is episode 180, and therefore it is time for us to talk about the fiction genre of pulp.
That movie has, like, forever ruined us describing this genre as it should be described.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's real hard.
Or Googling it.
Yeah, we had to figure out all sorts of ways to word this that would not involve us saying pulp fiction.
It doesn't help that there's also a bookstore or a chain of bookstores called that in Vancouver. Makes searching complicated.
Definitely. Speaking of locations, my name is Matthew. I'm a librarian in Fort Collins, Colorado, USA.
My name is Anna. I'm also a librarian in Fort Collins, Colorado, USA, which is located on the traditional and ancestral homelands of the Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Ute nations and peoples.
My name is Jam. I'm a librarian in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Stolo people.
My name is Megan. I'm an archivist in the National Capital Region of Canada. I live and work on the unceded traditional territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe.
Announcements.
Who won?
Oh, yes.
Matthew's looking it up, I presume.
Yes, I'm looking it up right now.
Do you want me to talk about the book list while you do that?
Please do.
So, in the show notes of this episode and at our website, bookclubform.com, you will find a book list of titles in this genre by authors of color. This list was challenging to make. I think depending, because this genre, I think, and we'll talk about it, is hard to pin down. So I think some of these, depending on your definition of what counts as pulp, might not fit everyone's, but I tried to get a list together of books by authors of color that I think will appeal for readers of pulp literature. So you can use them for your reader's advisory needs or your own reading interests.
Great. Announcement two, this episode is a week late, as you may have noticed, presumably. And if you missed the announcement last week, due to scheduling issues on our side, we did not realize that that several of us were traveling last weekend when we would normally record. Thankfully, August is a 5-Tuesday month, and so we've just pushed the episodes back, and you'll still be getting 2 episodes this month, and then we don't have to also have, like, one of those times where we, like, record 2 episodes, like, in a week or something. So, next episode is in 2 weeks from now, and then in September, we should all hopefully be back to normal. Final announcement, the drum roll can go in here, for the winner of the 2023 Battle of the Books for the One Podcast, One Book, Which Book Shall We All Read and Discuss competition is, which we announced several episodes ago. You, our listeners, got to vote, which one we did. There were 4 options. I'm just hamming this up to make it, like, you know, more dramatic.
So, literally all of us are, like, sitting here, like, doing drum rolls, handshakes, like, jazz hands. We're just ready for the announcement.
So the 4 options were Upright Woman Wanted, The Mushroom at the End of the World, Free a Child in a Country at the End of the World. Wait, it is only now that I realize that 2 of our books ended with At the End of the World. Really?
Enough delays, Matthew.
Did I write this down wrong? Okay.
You're killing us.
It was a vibe we were on.
That's so very strange. Okay. And also Spear. So anyway, the winner is Upright Woman Wanted at the End of the World. Clearly is the subtitle that that book should have.
I mean, it might be.
Yeah, it might be appropriate.
So that is the book that won, but all of them got votes, which is also great. So some of our listeners were interested in everything. I will also note, though, that, you know, one of the questions, there were two questions in the quiz, which was, what do you want us to read? And the second was, do you promise not to vote for more than one book? Or more than once. And so some of the responses here were entertaining to me. So there was things such as, I swear an Ira Glass's Precious American Life. A legacy this year I wanted to vote for all. Sadly, yes. I guess if I'm forced to. Pterodactyl. Yeah. And like others, no. Someone just said no. So like maybe they voted more than once. I don't know. But I was entertained by the responses that people gave for that as well. So thank you to all of our listeners who wrote more than just yes or no, I guess. Also, thank you to the listeners who wrote yes and didn't vote twice.
Also, I would like to note that Matthew pointed out to me earlier that proportionally of everyone who voted and all the, you know, selections that were made, it was my selection, The Mushroom at the End of the World, so that's what it's called. Like trying to remember now as I'm like saying it out loud. That was the people who voted for that one for my selection. Most likely to have said weird and random things for their I promise not to vote. I was the one who got the pterodactyl response. I was very happy with that.
Excellent.
So we'll be reading that book, and that episode will be out in September. No? Yes? Yeah, September. So second episode in September will be about that book. Anna and I bought a copy last weekend when we were traveling. So the episode may have gotten delayed, but we did buy a copy of the book.
I checked it out this week.
Good job. That's it for announcements. Hooray. A brief correction here. It is The Mushroom at the End of the World and Free a Child in a Country at the End of History. So while they both say at the end of, they're at the end of different things.
Now, what is Pulp Fiction?
Wow, now that is a question, isn't it?
Not the movie or the bookstore.
There must be a third thing we can say it's not as well, you know? Like, there's probably a beer called Pulp Fiction.
Almost definitely.
Some quick Googling is happening right now.
There's a Pulp Friction.
Is that pornography?
No, beer. I mean beer. There's a Pulp Friction beer. But it does sound like pornography, yes, indeed.
There's also a pulp nonfiction beer, it looks like.
Interesting. Anyway.
Pulp is kind of a genre, kind of a format. I think when I looked it up, the Wikipedia article said it was technically just magazines in the 30s and 40s that had stories on cheap paper. Literally pulp. The magazines were printed on pulp, and so they were poor quality paper.
I think that is at least reducing it to a certain geographic region, because I think that those cheap publications have been produced in non-English speaking countries for longer than just like the 20s to 40s or whatever it happened to be. And I think it's less of a genre and more of like a style, maybe, because I think it can apply to lots of different genres.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, it's always like, if it's pulp, it's gonna be like, to me, it's gonna be like sci-fi or horror or western or fantasy or romance or crime, detective, mystery. It's never gonna just be like literature.
And bonus points if it's spicy.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I had a struggle with this genre that I think I'm also going to have next month. Spoiler alert for our form. I guess it's a form and not a genre next month. It is lyric poetry. The struggle I have with both is that it is both like so broad that like so many things could potentially count for it that makes it like very hard to search for, and people don't, things that count for it aren't necessarily using that terminology, or like you could define it so narrowly that it's like it is specifically this thing from this specific time and place, And I'm like, well, I want to read something that counts, but I also want to look outside this like handful of magazines from the 30s. But yeah, it is definitely both has like a specific historic context, but can be applied super, super broadly. Yeah, which makes it hard to nail things down and do like a catalog search for it.
There's also the like, is it a genre question mark of like neopulp?
I hadn't heard of that before.
Like that's what like my zines are. Like that's what I would describe like Two-Fisted Library Stories as, which is like modern stuff written kind of in the style of pulp stuff. And that can apply like, you know, if someone writes like a modern The Shadow or Doc Savage story or whatever it happens to be, like that could be described as neopulp as well, because it's new in that style of things. I'm like 90% sure that that's a real term that people use, but it's possible I just like made it up.
I saw new pulp as I was looking, similar to new weird.
That would be good, because a lot of the old stuff is full of like casual racism and sexism. So
that's pretty much exactly what I was going to say. Like, I feel like that's also where it can be updated to mores and tropes and traditions that are a little more current to our time, because that is definitely like, yeah, there's an interesting paragraph in mine I kind of want to read out loud, because I'm like, yep, this reads about right for these stories.
Yeah, other people have used this term, so it's not just me. So
there is an interesting tension. So I read, not that I'm getting into what I'm reading, this is background reading I did in trying to figure out what the genre is. The Introduction to the Encyclopedia of Pulp Fiction Writers, The Essential Guide to More Than 200 Pulp Pioneers and Mass Market Masters. And there's this tension, I feel like, between things that fit the sort of definition of pulp as like any like mass produced literature for a very like common denominator audience, like stuff that's like very popular, not in like, you know, academic circles or like elite literary circles, but for the masses. And it talks about like the history before like the term pulp was used, like Penny Dreadfuls being literature for the masses. And I feel like we still have that. And I feel like it is sort of the like there's mysteries and thrillers and authors like James Patterson, who very similar to a lot of like pulp writers, like lots of other people write James Patterson books, but he has the popular name. And so they put his name on it, like a lot in common with pulp fiction in the historical sense. But I don't think he would ever call his stuff pulp fiction. Whereas like neopulp are folks who are emulating a style of historical pulp fiction. But are not like popular, you know, widely read literature. So it is interesting how there's been, yeah, how that has sort of shifted.
I came across a book a little while ago called Who's Who in New Pulp that came out in 2020, a comprehensive guide to the writers, artists, and publishers in the new pulp movement. And let me tell you, this is the most white male genre that you have encountered. I'll show Anna the cover, but like, oh my gosh. So there is like still, I don't know, like interest in this sort of thing. But I do wonder about the reasons why people are interested in writing this sort of thing, modern stuff. Like you talked, Anna, about like wanting to update the like aspects related to gender and race and things like that. And I'm like, are some of these people writing this because they don't want to do that?
There was maybe a lot of overlap with the idea of what made pulp exciting when it was first being written, and then like that adventure style story where it's, I guess, because it focuses more on plot and the excitement of the story, it feels a little bit simpler and safer to enjoy. Like it feels less complicated in some ways. You don't have to worry about the ways in the world is kind of complicated sometimes.
So I was thinking in terms of publishing that probably a fair amount of why pulp isn't a thing anymore, it has to do as much with the publishing industry. Because, as you pointed out, Jan, like, there are James Patterson's and a whole tradition of like thrillers and things like that now that are a known genre of publishing that with their own marketing system and their own list of authors that produce in that area, which would have overlapped with the field of pulp in the past. And similarly to that, there are the romance novels. Mm-hmm. There are the suspense novels. There are mysteries, detective fiction, like all these sorts of things have their own areas. And in fact, one of the things I was reading briefly talked about how in the 1930s, the pulp magazine started to specialize in genres, and that gave the option for instance, the author that I was reading to write under a variety of pen names for each of these different ones, writing different genres, right? And that still happens some these days, right? Now people still write in under different pen names for different genres. And so that's sort of where I feel like there's some of that in terms of how the publishing industry has changed and in terms of how we as readers then relate to all of this. But that doesn't mean that there aren't still sort of a pulp genre, because I actually think about it now in relation to people doing like small press or self-publishing for like Amazon books and stuff like that.
I think like Kindle books are kind of a modern pulp, but also I would say a big quote unquote modern pulp thing are like the cell phone novels and web novels from Japan that are where like isekai has grown out of as a genre, which are like the transported to another world, which are like so many manga and light novels are based on that. And I think those are very pulp inspired, and that they're like often kind of serials. Their light novels are not that long, honestly, and they're not necessarily trying. I don't know how to say this without being like demeaning to multiple genres and creators. So like, yeah, I'll just edit this out.
They're trying for fun readability as opposed to like,
yeah, they're not trying for be literary.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
They're not trying for the height of artistry. They're trying for the fun and thrill and enjoyment of just like eating that, essentially, right? And it's like the consumption of enjoyable food is like the consumption of this quick, enjoyable.
Another comparison could be like webtoons, another of those like comics that are designed to be read on your cell phone that I loathe due to my love of the artist form, the artistic form of comics being bastardized by these web. Anyway, I'm poking fun at myself. Please note this.
Yeah. I just miss when everyone had their own website. I would be super interested to learn more about like the history of pulp literature or whatever it's called, this sort of literature cross-culturally, because the intro that I read in the encyclopedia did say, you know, specifically this is about like English language, US and British pulp fiction, but there are definitely literary traditions from other places in the world that have a similar history, and part of it is because it's tied into like the history of access to literacy. And as like people could learn to read, then these mass appeal, super cheap to make publications started coming out for them. And so I feel like it'd be such an interesting lens to learn about like the history of you know, written language and literacy and education in another culture to see what their spicy stories were like or what form their pulp literature took.
I know there was a big kind of tradition. I don't know. There's a lot of the stuff published in Mexico and Spanish, as an example, that you sometimes like, especially in parts of the U.S., like you will see evidence of that stuff around. I read a book of pulp stuff from India. So I think it has existed in pretty much every country, and we just don't really get exposed to the majority of it. Because honestly, like, why would you translate this becomes a major question a lot of the time.
Well, and I would also suggest some of that is I feel like pulp in a lot of ways is responding to a very current cultural condition, right? So I think a lot of what hops out off of these in terms of tropes and ideas and things that people are exploring in these stories is like, what is the thing of the day that is going to get the most people to show up and pay attention and be like, oh yeah, that is an issue right now. And so I feel like some of the, like the stories that I was reading, a lot of it was about, was thinly veiled references to, like, Red Scare stuff, or like to, you know, various types of othering that really wasn't per se looking at race. It was clear it was looking at like other aspects of it. And so it was kind of like clearly conditioned towards this, like, you know, communist Red Scare sort of attitude. And that was of the time at which it was written. So the particular book that I read, those stories were, they were published in 1960, right? So like 1950s would have been full of that.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because like in the Soviet Union, like there were detective stories, mysteries, science fiction stories and all of that stuff. And like, even though they were more limited in what they could write about, they were still writing these novels and stories. And they were popular in those countries as well. They were quite popular. And my understanding is that, like, the only reason they were not more popular is because the government limited how many copies were published. So, because you were supposed to read, like, Marx and Lenin instead of, like, the detective story.
Experience, background.
Yeah. What's your background in reading pulp?
Well, I've published a zine called Two-Fisted Library Stories that I would describe as containing pulp style fiction. Most of the issues are currently, I've been putting them up on itch.io this year because it is the 10th anniversary of the first issue coming out, which is horrifying to me. but there are 10-ish issues. Most of them are up there now. It is valuable enough culturally that the Library of Congress has put it most of the issues in their collection. So, you know, some people think it's important. And if you want to read stupid stories about library workers, like, doing weird stuff, you can go and look at that. It's free. You can download it for free. Print your own copies, even. There's printable versions and web versions for you to look at. I've read a lot of this stuff. I've read the old stuff. I've read the new stuff. Like, I've bought, like, the facsimile copies of, like, The Shadow and read those.
He's read the weird books that are, like, just about the genre. Yeah,
I've read books about these genres. Like, I love this stuff, and I think it's also terrible. Like, so, yeah, I was excited for this episode. And, yeah. Because I find it very appealing in theory, if not in practice.
Our listeners are going to be so disappointed that Matthew isn't suffering this episode.
Well, to be fair, I did read some stuff I hated, so.
Perfect.
I've definitely gone back and read pulp era science fiction. A little bit of Conan.
I've really read almost nothing from like what would actually be, you know, considered pulp from the actual era. The closest would be just like, you know, reading what I would consider similar to modern day pulp fiction, which is like some of the like self-published little novels and things that end up in Amazon that kind of are just kind of fun, quick reads.
I've looked at a lot of covers.
That's almost the most fun part. Yeah.
Yeah. He likes the visual aesthetic a lot. Is.
Yeah. I love the aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. I have read Lovecraft, and I think that might kind of be it. I feel like I've read some older sci-fi stories, but I don't know that I've specifically read any other authors that from the sort of classic time period and sort of tropiness or stylistically close to pulp sci-fi. But I read Lovecraft because I grew up in Rhode Island and worked in a library that gets mentioned in one of his stories, and it felt prudent.
Like, I guess it also depends on like how broad you want to define this genre, you know? Like, does like Sherlock Holmes count as pulp? Or is it like too good?
Well, I did accidentally find a like modern Sherlock Holmes retelling with a modern version of one of those pulp style covers appended onto it with like very like pulp inspired description of like what the story was when I was searching through like Libby for options for this month. And I was like very surprised that that was like available to me in Libby. And there was it was a whole series of like pulp inspired modern materials that had like this fake pulp, you know, fiction cover style to them.
I'm sure Sherlock Holmes has met like every one has encountered like overlapped with all of these things. I know like there's a Neil Gaiman wrote a Sherlock Holmes like Cthulhu Lovecraft story. And probably everyone else has interacted with Sherlock Holmes as well. So pulp by adoption, maybe at least. Okay, we have to get going because otherwise I will make this episode take 8 million years.
Yes.
So did you try and look for anything different from what you'd read before? Like what was your search strategy, Matthew?
So I read three things this month, or parts of three things. I actually went back to episode 19 of the podcast. Way back in year one, when we were all in Vancouver, before Jam was on the podcast, because for that episode, which was New Weird, I read a book called Sensuous Science Fiction from the Weird and Spicy Pulps for that episode, because that is the sort of thing that I will read. And one of the stories in that was about a hero called Zenith Rand, Planet Vigilante. And I... do we want to talk about search strategies more?
Well, nobody else has talked about search strategies. Just describe your search strategy. Just don't go too far into it.
So that was one I read. Another was a book that I'd seen for sale at a used bookstore years ago that stayed in my mind because I was like, you're really curious about it. And then the third one is I went to a bookshop and looked in their magazine rack for what I was wondering what the like modern equivalent of pulp might be.
I had okay success just looking for pulp as a search term in the library catalog. I found a few things and tried a few things. And then I went also looking for things I thought might count as like classic. So I looked for Tarzan and I wanted to get something else, I think by the same author, but I didn't manage to get a hold of it. So I was hoping for more space, Mars-type books, but didn't end up reading that kind of thing this month.
I checked out, as aforementioned, the Encyclopedia of Pulp Fiction Writers, a print resource to help me find books. I ended up using it a little bit. I did end up, the one, spoiler alert, I didn't read a lot this month. I read one short story along with the Encyclopedia of this, or the introduction of this encyclopedia. But I also read for fun. So it was a win. It was a win month. I did end up reading a short story by an author that I found in the encyclopedia. I had also checked out a couple anthologies just based on like a keyword search for pulp that had pulp in the title or the subtitle. And I also ended up finding and really liked the idea of using these, but didn't end up doing it. A bunch of online collections of pulp magazines. I will include some of those in the show notes, but since a lot of these are out of copyright, they're available online. And I liked the idea of just like choosing one at random and reading a few stories from it, but I didn't end up doing that because there's just too many of them and I didn't know like where to start and what kind of quality I was going to get. I know that's not the point of the exercise, but I just didn't do it.
Fair. So, and I did look in Libby for options. I borrowed a couple of things, but nothing was really jumping out at me. I'm also using Libby primarily for audiobooks, and I just could not bring myself to listen to an audiobook. It did not sound like a good idea right now. But actually, what I had the most fun doing by far and away was we went to one of those bookshops that's basically just a house that has been jammed full of as many bookshelves as it is physically possible to get in there, regardless entirely of health and safety standards, as far as I could tell. And in it, there is a significant collection of old books from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s and eras like that. And they had just like spinner racks of old paperbacks that you could go through. And I just pulled up a Wikipedia list of Pulp Fiction authors and looked for different authors on those racks and pulled a handful of different books and selected a couple to read, partially by looking up their like Wikipedia articles and being like, does this guy have an article that describes him as a very obvious jerk or a horrifying person? I won't get that one. Oh, this one doesn't say anything about them being a jerk or a horrible person. Well, they might have been, but it doesn't say it explicitly. So, okay, this one's worth trying. so like I did a little bit of that real quick on the fly, but it was by far and away the most fun way to approach this one. And so to some degree, Jam, I sort of did the thing where I was like, just found a bunch of the old stories that all of these stories, well, not all of them, but many of them were probably in, you know, in the public domain at this point. Not the particular ones I read, but like some of the other ones that I looked at. And I could have just picked some off of, you know, that online, but it was fun to go through old paperbacks and like handle them and look through them and see their aesthetics and chat with Matthew about some of the cover designs and stuff like that, and then just pick a few.
That is like peak ideal book experience right there.
It's peak like Pulp Fiction experience, I think. Like if you're going to go and pick out some pulp books to read, I think that is an awesome way to do it.
One final thing about genre that I'll mention and defining things is I read this month the introduction to a book from a while ago. The introduction is written by Michael Chabon, who wrote The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And he edited an anthology called McSweeney's Enchanted Chamber of Astonishing Stories, and I think his introduction about genre and what makes something science fiction or fantasy or like pulp is an interesting thing. Yeah. So I think that's worth reading if you want to check it out. I didn't actually read the rest of the book yet, but I have read the introduction.
Can I read a quote from the introduction of this encyclopedia that I wanted to share? This is a little list of just to get an idea of how many, like the variety and how many different things are encompassed by pulp, even from one specific time period. The quote is, "Eventually, in the multitudinous try-anything boom years of the 1930s, readers could find pulps dedicated to stories of spies, World War I flying aces, FBI agents, famous trials, sex, foreign legionnaires, weird menaces, zeppelins, and the singular adventures of various superheroes."
Yeah, it is. Like, we really only think of this in regards to like science fiction and fantasy and horror and stuff, because those are the genres that are still popular. And there were so many other pulp genres that were produced at that time that, you know, how many Zeppelin stories are still being written?
I mean, isn't that steampunk?
Fair.
I guess you're right. Zeppelin fic. I like weird menaces.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, weird menace is good.
Yeah. I also think that like some of the reason why we still associate the science fiction stuff is because it's actually science fiction has a magic way of always being relevant, because science fiction is always coming to be our current reality, right? And so it's very easy to look back at those and be like, oh yeah, that actually happened, or that didn't happen, or that happened in this way or this other way. And so it stays somehow relevant, and therefore it's an easy thing to go back and reapproach. Whereas some of the things like the Western ones or stuff like that are just not going to stay as relevant in the same way, or are going to be supplanted over time with new versions of tropes within that kind of area.
So Xanath Rand, Planet Vigilante, was the one that I remembered from reading the story years ago in the Weird and Sensual Pulps book. And so I discovered that there were some other Xanath Rand stories, and that someone had put out a collection of them on print on demand on Amazon. And so I bought it a couple years ago and I hadn't had a chance to read it. And it's three stories. I reread the one that I'd read a million years ago, in 20, something, something, 20XX, and read the two other stories. And I think the first one was the best, honestly. And these ones stood out to me because the female character, the woman in this, was like treated with some degree of like respect that you don't always see in old science fiction, even science fiction much later. I've read science fiction that is so fucking sexist that it's like upsetting that it has any degree of popularity. And these ones were like in no way ideal, but they're like, they stated specifically like, like women are equal to men in the year of like 2800 something something, you know, and she can be just as good at like, you know, flying spaceships and being a planet vigilante as the men can. They kind of take turns rescuing each other in all the stories. So like while she might be like a quote unquote damsel in distress, she also like breaks chains with her Amazonian strength to save him and stuff like that. They're very silly stories. But like they're fun enough. I think the first one where like they weren't actually a couple was the best. I thought that was more interesting and I thought than the others, but they're fine. The one thing that disappointed me, because I went back and I realized that I actually had some photographs of the original book, because the book had reproduced the pages from the pulp. So it had included like the ads and stuff that were also there. And that was like, was a facsimile edition. That was really fun. Whereas this version, like it had the art and stuff, but it like had like redone all the text. And I'm like, I would rather have read a facsimile edition of this to really kind of capture the essence of that. I saw someone has released like, it looks like a zine version of this, that you can buy on like eBay from some like micropress, cause these are like public domain stories. So maybe that one's reproduced them in facsimile edition, which would be a more fun way to read these, I think. But yeah. Like, I can't recommend these. This is what I went back and listened to episode 19, you know? And it's just like, there's a thing. It's like, these are only recommended to people like Matthew, who have very terrible taste. But there's much worse stuff out there. That's what I can say.
You reminded me real quick, Matthew, that on one of the books that I did not read that I went and picked up from that bookstore, you actually pointed out to me that there's an ad on the back of it that says, "Now on sale everywhere, The Music Man. Read it, see it. Meredith Willson's heartwarming new novel, The Big Movie of 1962.
Yeah, just an ad on the back cover of a science fiction novel, which is wild. Yeah, I should say, like, these are sci-fi stories with, like, aliens and stuff, like, in spaceships, and, like, oh my gosh, the technology doesn't make any fucking sense, which is, I love it. Like, it's like, what is this spaceship? It's basically, like, an airplane, right? That's how they're gonna work. No problem here. All works fine. Space technology is just magic.
Yes.
And some very silly aliens. So what book did you read, Anna?
So I'll go next.
Well, I'm talking about spaceships and aliens.
I was drawn to the sci-fi aspect. So I did all the ones that I picked out to try were sci-fi ones. I was reading The Aliens by Murray Leinster? Leinster. Which is a pen name for William F. Jenkins, I believe was his name. Sorry, I won't pull up his thing, so I'm reading accurate information, because I thought as long as I'm going to read about this or read a book by this person, I might as well read about them just a little bit. So he was born in 1896, which is like one of those moments when you're like, oh, wow, time. These were a long time ago. My goodness. And he wrote just a ton, like 1,500 short stories or something like that, that got published throughout the 30s, 40s, well, 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. He served in both World War I and World War II, basically in intelligence department sort of roles. And he also wrote during all that time and got like short stories and plays and other things published. He never got to be a super big name per se. Like he wasn't an Isaac Asimov, but he was known and he influenced a lot of those writers.
I'd heard of him.
Yeah. And in fact, some of the things that he wrote about, we know about. In fact, he's the person who coined the term first contact. That comes from one of his stories. And also, one of the stories he's particularly well known for is called A Logic Named Joe, and it's one of the very first stories about a computer, and the idea of computers being networked and connected, and there actually being servers, and all of the they were called tanks in his story, but they were basically servers, and about the idea of an internet, and about the idea of an internet going haywire and giving people wild information and stuff like that. Like, that's one of the stories he wrote that he got was very well known for. So intriguingly, he kind of had a perception of the chaotic times in which we would be in today. So the stories that I read from this, so this was a short story collection. So these were all short stories. They were not linked or anything. They're different, different characters. Although the main characters in these are all like guys who are basically actually the same character. I read somebody just commenting on his stories and how like they're relatively well written in that they flow pretty well and they're fast and they're like comfortable to read, but they have this tendency to use the sort of ordinary man voice in them that does not translate through time terribly well. It does not read quite right anymore. And in both, like in the two big stories that I read, like the long ones, in both of them, the main character is a guy being the hero while some woman is in the background being largely irrelevant, and then he gets married to her at the end. He proposes and they get married during the course of the story, which the story lasts like 12 hours in the first one of those and I think 24 hours in the other one worth of time. Like, they're really kind of, I mean, these are people that supposedly known each other a little bit before this, but not very much.
They lived life fast back then.
Yeah, I don't know. So it's kind of interesting. Like, I was going to read this one little section that I thought was like very representative of how the female characters were used in this. So this paragraph reads, "She smiled at him and quickly and moved away. Just as a man can find it possible to tell a girl his inmost and most private thoughts after knowing her only a week, a girl can find possible the most unquestioning obedience within limits in a similar length of time."
What?
So this is not going to be high on the like gender equality scale on these things, but I will say one of the other things, the other story though was very significantly about like the main antagonist of the story was a person who is so xenophobic that they just wanted to kill anyone who was different from them on sight. And so this was like first contact with aliens and they were just out to destroy these aliens instantly, just wanted to like atom bomb them out of existence. And the hero is like kind of like trying to stop them and everybody else is kind of trying to be like, hold on, buddy. But basically like in the narrative, the kind of one of the essential main components of the story is a declaration that like being xenophobic is basically makes you unfit for public service or public office or any kind of public like role in the world because you just cannot make reasonable decisions about how we interact with each other. So in that, I was kind of like, okay, like this is like a main theme of this is that xenophobia is bad and should not, people who are xenophobic should not have major roles of power in the world and should be taken out of those places. I was like, okay, well that at least, I could get behind that. I don't agree with your treatment of women, but anyways, they were reasonably fun. They were interesting. It's kind of interesting just to read the ideas and concepts that was haunting his mind, particularly in relation to using like aliens as a way to explore a variety of different ways that we relate to each other and to the world around us.
Like, this is what I was saying with like how the stories I read were like not great, but better than their treatment of women than a lot of stuff. So mine says, "She was laughing as she strode toward him with the easy grace of a woman tempering the strength of a man. Women were on par with men in the 50th century of Terra's interstellar expansion. pilotess Sandra Yates was a Valkyr of the Black Space Guys. Not as strong as the strongest of the spacemen, but just as agile and expert on the control switches and just as fast on the blast gun trigger. Nor had she lost her charm in training for manhood's hardships. The Valkyrs were virile as women could be, virile and matched with the best of their men.
Sure.
Oh, dear.
And when you're like, well, that's the better representation of women, it's like the bar is pretty low.
I feel like I hear that and I can imagine someone at a typewriter being like, this is a feminist credo. I'm really doing one for the ladies. This is. I can talk next about the story that I read because it is also about aliens and xenophobia.
Go for it.
And more specifically, racism. So I read All the Colors of the Rainbow by Lee Brackett, originally published in 1957. This was an author that I saw in the Encyclopedia of Pulp Fiction Writers, and then found a story by her in the anthology The Future is Female, 25 Classic Science Fiction Stories by Women from Pulp Pioneers to Ursula K. Le Guin. So theoretically, there were a bunch of stories in here I could have read, but this was the name that I recognized from reading a bit of the encyclopedia. So it is, yeah, very much about, I mean, xenophobia, but like more specifically racism. It is about aliens who, it is a couple, a male and female alien. And part of me, I feel like indicative of like the time in science fiction that the aliens were like very humanoid. There was a male alien and a female alien who were in like a pretty normal seeming heterosexual relationship, and you know, spoke English, breathed oxygen, and I was almost a little refreshed by the fact that it's like we don't have to deal with like explaining how they're here and breathing oxygen and speaking English. Who cares? Yeah, that we skipped over those more hard sci-fi details. There are some like gender norms that are implied to be like different where they come from, where. It says like all of the males of their species are wearing like shirts and pants, even though it is uncomfortable, because like if they wear like all the women can wear sort of like tunics or whatever that are closer to what they would all wear at home. But the men feel a lot of pressure to perform masculinity for humans. Yes, the sort of overarching plot, these aliens have arrived on Earth, are part of this galactic federation that wants to bring Earth into their fold, and have, you know, made contact with the government, all of this background stuff that happened before the story. And then the story itself is just about these two who are like driving on a long drive to go somewhere and it doesn't matter. They're doing a research thing. The like plot of the story happens when they are on this long drive and you know, find this little town on their way. They're in Mississippi and pull in to find a hotel and spend the night. And besides being like mostly humanoid, like the thing that we know about them is that they have green skin, and drive into like what might be described as a sundown town, is an all white town, and are like immediately like, people start like gathering around their car as soon as they park, they go into the hotel and are immediately like told like, no, we don't have any rooms. And also no one in this town has any rooms for you. And also all of our restaurants are closing early. And yes, escalates from there without recounting the whole story, escalates from there until, like a very like violent incident happens, which includes like a sexual assault that does not happen on the page, but is heavily implied that it occurred. The aliens end up, not all of the aliens, but these two in particular, are like, we quit this assignment, we're going home. And the thing that they sort of communicate to their, like they're talking to their government contact at the end. And he's like, I'm so sorry this happened. And I wish you could see more of this planet. So you'd see we're not, so, you know, some of us are civilized. And they're like, That, you know, that's kind of not the issue. Like, the issue is like, we're no longer fit to be here. And they don't say like, because we're traumatized, but like the implication is like, we need to go like, get some help that we can't get here. Yeah, it is a story about like the trauma of experiencing racism and like the trauma of experiencing sexual assault through this lens of alien visitors who like very literally like are called like green and word and like the connection is not subtle. Yeah, and I think there are still some things that like feel very much like, even though it's written by a woman, it is mostly from the perspective of like the male person in this alien couple, who I think fits the profile of like pulp fiction, you know, sort of square jawed and like takes care of his lady friend all of this stuff. But I do think there were some things like, you know, very relieved that the sexual assault happened completely off of the page. I don't know if that would be the case necessarily in the hands of a writer who was not a woman. I think it was a story. I guess it is technically a novelette. I just looked it up and it was originally published in Venture Science Fiction magazine and listed as a novelette. One that I'm glad that I read and will think about probably for a while.
Well, things I will not think about for a while are the Blaft Anthology of Tamil Pulp Fiction, which is all fiction that was originally published in India in the Tamil language that was translated into English for the first time for this anthology. And so this is, it collects short stories from various authors from the 60s up to the 2000s. It was popular enough that it got two sequels released as well. So there's two other, books in the series. They have great covers. The stories were not to my liking, is the politest way to say it. I thought these were unenjoyable to read. I really just kind of skimmed this. I read it. It's interesting because it has multiple stories by the same authors. So there's like a lot of the authors have multiple stories. So I tended to just kind of read the shortest ones from each person. So I got a kind of overview of what it was. And there's like sci-fi and romance and mystery detective stuff. And like what was more interesting was like the introduction and like some of the stuff, the biographical stuff about the authors that talks about how they've written like hundreds of novels. And you're like, how do you write hundreds of novels? And then you read these stories and you're like, oh, that's how you write hundreds of novels. It's like, I don't think there's a lot of editing going on with these stories. It's kind of like one of them is like, I have to write like 10 to 20 pages every day, which is like kind of a wild amount of stuff to be writing. And then probably not revising that much either. I don't know. But it was really interesting to read and get like exposed to some stuff from another culture. So I'm glad I looked at that. One section that was truly baffling was that some of them have, after the stories by the authors, there's Q&As. And it's like a Q&A with Rajesh Kumar. And so I'm looking at the Q&A and I read these. And so the first question is, do you write the story to fit a title or the title to match a story? Like, sure, that's a fairly reasonable question to ask a writer. Second question, the Indian cricket team seems to be taking a bad beating recently. No? And then he goes off for a paragraph talking about how bad the Indian cricket team is. And I later realized by looking at a different Q&A in this book that these are also reprints from columns that they have, Q&A columns that they have in these like pulp magazines that their stories are published in. And so readers are just sending them different like questions all the time. And they just took some, like, here's a column from this random week, but it doesn't tell you that. And I'm like, why, what is going on with this Q&A? This is like nonsense. And then it goes on to some other like weird questions and stuff. Interesting. The covers are great of these books. A lot of like stolen art and stuff as well, which I thought was really interesting. In some of these, like some of them are also like original art and everything that, you know, people have created, but some of them are also just like stealing art from other things, like tracing off of it, which I thought was kind of interesting. There's a picture in one of them that I'm positive is like a drawing of Sauron, the dinosaur pterodactyl person from X-Men comics. And I was like, I'm positive I've seen this somewhere and I could not find it anywhere. The one is very funny. It's like, this is the cover to, front cover from Best Novel featuring Matchstick Number One. And then it says the Christina Aguilera vampire image apparently originally posted to freakingnews.com by Josh Max. And it just said apparently took this picture of Christina Aguilera as a vampire and put it as their cover. So that's the sort of thing that you're getting in these as well. So, which I thought was really interesting. So yeah, I found the writing about these more interesting than the actual stories.
I'll talk about one of the ones that I read. I picked up a collection of comic, they're more like comic pages that were in other published magazines, and they're a collection of Sally the Sleuth, which was a character created by Adolph Barrow.
I own that book.
Really?
You should have seen, like, the movement Matthew made when you said that name. Like, he just, like, popped up and was like,
his face absolutely lit up.
Those are really fun stories, I thought, by my standards.
So the foreword is by Tim Hanley, who's also done a number of other books about female comic characters like Lois Lane and Wonder Woman. And it was published by Bedside Press in 2018. So it's, the collection is recent, even if the actual comics themselves are from the 30s and 40s, and then which were the black and white ones. And then the later ones are in color, and they're quite different in style and like content, sort of. Sally the Sleuth is the assistant to a private investigator, a detective of some kind. And I saw one description that called it sexual escapades, but that's not what it is. It's basically they have a crime that Sally is helping sleuth out things, and then there is some reason why her clothes get taken away from her. Either the bad guy grabs at her dress and it, like, rips, and so she's exposed, or, you know, she is seducing someone, or, you know, she gets captured and they take away her clothes as a matter of course because they're going to chain her up because terrible things are going to happen. And then sometimes she'll get rescued by the, I don't even know what the name of the detective guy is, really. He'll show up and rescue her with the police and stuff like that. Or maybe the urchin, whose name I also forget. It's like Peanut or something. It's the ugliest child I've ever seen represented in comic strip form, and I couldn't understand why they decided to do that to him. So what's interesting is in the introductory text, they talk about what the advice that was given to the creators of these comic strips for how they could treat nudity of women in these strips. So, like, if there was a man in the scene, they at least had to have some article of clothing covering part of their body. If they were alone, they could be completely naked. And if it was a dead person, they could be naked, but the man could never be unclothed in any format whatsoever. So there's a lot of, like, I'm not even sure how the bras are supposed to stay up. I didn't quite understand. But anyway, then, so like 2/3 the way through, the format in which it was getting published before was affected by a bunch of things. And then they switched to straight, like, crime. And these are the color ones. And so there's no more clothes falling off. And it really is just trying to solve terrible crimes and mysteries and stuff. And it's funny that one of the images from one of the strips gets pulled up when is it Comstock? The guy who wrote the book that was like, comics are ruining our children.
Seduction of the Innocent, Frederick Wortham.
Yeah. And it's just a woman lying on the ground and someone says, oh, golly, she's dead.
Yeah. This sort of thing is really like kind of the reason why there was a comics code for so long. But also, like, this is like the best of these sorts of things. In that, like, she has some degree of agency and stuff in these stories. You know, she's not just a victim.
No. I mean, often she's still solving the crime. She sees clues and she puts things together and, you know, shoots people and kicks them and, you know, is an active person, not just a damsel in distress, although there are a lot of implied basically sexual assault as part of what happens to her. So, be forewarned, not on screen, as it were, but as part of the storyline. So, it was neat to read comics from that era, since I think I don't really go for that normally, and so it was interesting to see what they were publishing in the magazines at the same time. Like, this was pre-superheroes, basically, for a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that I believe a lot of these were originally printed in the pulps. And so these would be the comic pages in an anthology that was otherwise prose fiction.
Yeah. And in terms of racism, it was a lot of like Asian stuff.
Yellow Peril.
Yeah, Yellow Peril. Oh my God, the morphine and white slavery kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like, we're reading the best of these things, the most like progressive of these things, and they're still like kind of abhorrent in many ways. So the final thing I read was, I was like, well, what's like the modern equivalent of pulp? And I was like, you know what? I believe there's still print science fiction and fantasy anthology magazines being published. Some of these have been printed for a really long time. And so I'm like, I'm going to go and try and see if I can find one and read it. And we were in another town. We were down in Denver and we went to some bookshops. And I found one called Planet Scum, with two M's, which is relatively recent compared to a lot of the others. It describes itself on its website as, and this is when I was like, okay, I should probably buy this one. Born out of reverence for the bizarre science fiction magazines of the pulp era, our anthology showcased curated short story collections of original fiction by international authors. And it actually started out as a zine, it looks like. It describes in somewhere that like they stapled the original copies themselves. And so it's only up to issue 15. So it hasn't been coming out that year. They put it 3 issues a year. So it's about 5 years old. And it just had a bunch of short stories in it and some other content. It's like 100-something pages long. The thing that makes it really pulpy is that I got it for 14 cents because the person in the bookshop didn't realize it rang it up wrong. And it just started because it wasn't in their section. They were like, a magazine. And I'm like, how much is this? And they're like, 14. And instead of charging $14 for it, it cost us 14 cents. And they didn't realize because we were buying several other books at the same time. So pure pulp for 14 cents, 100% worth it. But also, like, I'm actually going to get a subscription to it because I kind of want to read more of this sort of thing. I looked it up online. The subscription rates are really cheap. And so I'm gonna get a subscription and, like, try and read more of this sort of thing because I do like it. There was one story in it that I thought was really terrible. And I looked it up afterwards. I'm like, oh, this is so bad. I'm like, oh, this has been reprinted. Like, it had been reprinted from another science fiction magazine, and it has been reprinted, like at least one other time as well somewhere else. And I'm like, why are people reprinting the story so much? And then I was like, so it's like, what a great satirical story this was. I'm like, this was satire? I did not understand it was satire. It's very American. And I think that's the thing. And I was like, I did not understand it to be satirical because a lot of it was American references that I did not understand. And I also was just like, without the context of this is satirical, I was like, I took it at face value. As being more like American mythological than it is intended to be, I suppose.
What was the story?
It was called The Battle of York by James Stoddard. Yes, it is 3,000 years in the future, and America no longer exists, and historians are trying to retell the founding of America based on like folk tales. And so it's kind of like trying to mixing up a bunch of different aspects of America to make something that is like, I guess, satirical about American culture. But to me, it just seemed like, America's great. And I'm just like, but I really needed the context surrounding it to tell me that it was supposed to be satire for me to realize this.
Just glancing at it, it looks like I'm probably going to read it. It's probably going to be hilarious to me as somebody who grew up in the States with a U.S. education. It does remind me a little bit of when I read The Importance of Being Earnest for a class, and then in class, everybody hated it. And then my professor was talking about it and like the humor and stuff. And somebody was like, wait, this was a comedy? She was like, oh yes, you missed. This is important context for you to have. They're like, it just seemed like a lot of rich people with stupid problems. And it's like, yeah, that's hilarious.
Yeah, I can see it being a similar thing. But it was just like a lot of, like, I was just not getting the references because I'm like, I don't know anything about the founding of America. And honestly, nor do I really care that much.
Fair.
But I just don't have any, like, cultural connection to the history of America, really, or knowledge of, like, who Betsy Ross is. Is that a person?
That is a person.
It's not the Hulk's wife. That's Betty Ross. I wonder if that's why she's named that. Okay.
Probably.
Okay. My last book will add a little bit of Canadian content, only not. I'm going to read a bit from the foreword. It has been said that Canadian fiction tends to be a realistic literature, which does not take kindly to heroes. Perhaps that's why so many of the improbable but entertaining Mountie stories were turned out by foreigners. So there's only like one Canadian author in the whole collection. It's all, I think, mostly just written by Americans. But I read three stories out of it. There was The Deadly Trek to Albertville by Talmage Powell, which was the Mountie shows up to take a prisoner somewhere else, and then there's a deadly shootout. The Frozen Phantom, which was they're looking for a mining claim, and the guide thinks there's a horrible phantom in the area, and it turns out to be a big trick by someone who's trying to collect his mineral claim without interference. So they set up this distraction. And then Spoilers of the Last World by Roger Daniels is someone comes in from the barren wastelands and is like obsessed with this dream of ivory or something and infects the other person with the dream, when they die, basically. And then so he goes off into the wilderness and discovers a secret world, and then gets stuck there forever. So I kind of enjoyed how the like lines between what's Western and what might be like fantasy or science fiction are a little bit loose. Like it could have been a real ghost, and then it ends up being someone with a terrible science fiction coffin that drives people crazy because it's made out of terrible material. Like, we don't really know how the world works, so anything is still possible.
When were these from?
So they were from, I don't have the dates for the particular stories themselves, but it is 30s, 20s, 30s.
I just realized that the Northerns, as I think maybe these are called sometimes instead of Westerns. I don't know. Yeah. Canada's relationship with like itself is really strange. But I'm like, if people think like for a lot of Canadians, especially ones of like my generation, it's like, if you think about it like that, it's like, I think of like the Canadian Minute about Sam Steele, who like kicked at some American who wanted to bring guns into Canada, and gambling stuff or whatever. And without really doing anything. And people are like, yeah, Sam Steele's awesome. And I'm like, sure. Yes. I'm sure. I'll link to the Canadian Minute in the show notes so people, non-Canadians, can understand what I'm talking about, or Canadians that just have not seen that Canadian Minute. It's a pretty entertaining one, I feel. Because we get the better of Americans.
I'm an American. You can't do this to me.
In that case, I'll be lenient. We'll keep this gambling gear, and you'll be back in the United States by sundown.
That's really all that like Canadians want. Like this like, you know, 1 minute video that like gives us like a vague sense of superiority over America.
Appeal factors.
Superiority over America.
Oh, 100%. That's why I read any of these things.
I was going to say, anytime it has come up in any social gathering that I did not grow up here and have not seen most of the like 1 minutes, the minutes, whatever they're called.
Canadian Heritage Minutes.
There's like an outcry. And it certainly feels like people are very excited to feel superior to me as an American for a little bit. Which is, I'm fine with, you know, I would do the same thing if I was Canadian. But yes, it does seem like an important bonding aspect of the Canadian Heritage Minutes is feeling superior to Americans.
Okay, so like an aside, we did sports nonfiction a while ago, and I linked to a bunch of Heritage Minutes in the show notes for that one. I don't remember why, but I literally went and watched all of them. I watched every single Heritage Minute when, like, instead of doing like editing that podcast.
We watched several Heritage Minutes at my birthday party last year.
I think it is like imperative of any American who genuinely spends an amount of time in Canada. Like I spent those like 4 years there. You have to watch some Heritage Minutes. You have to watch the log jumpers waltz.
Log drivers.
Thank you. Log drivers waltz.
We watched that one. Yep. That was the one. Where the folks, they're like, though it was my birthday party, they took control. They're like, no, we're watching it. We're watching the log driver's waltz right now.
If you ask any girl from the parish around what pleases her most from her head to her toes, she'll say, I'm not sure that it's business of yours, but I do like to waltz with the log driver.
I don't know if this is in part of the, like, you know, becoming a citizen thing there, but it should be if it isn't, because clearly it is required by a culturally required, like it may not be like required by the government, but the culture requires it of you.
We actually know someone who was in one of the Heritage Minutes videos as well. Someone that went to library school with us appeared in one about the Vancouver Asahi baseball team, mm-hmm. about the Japanese baseball team in Vancouver before World War II.
Yeah.
That's how Canadian it is. We know someone who was in them. Also, they will claim like any ownership over any sort of Canadian thing possible. There's one about Superman. There's one about like basketball.
I know about the basketball one.
I mean, he was from Ontario, but they were in the States when it happened.
There's a number of others that are like that as well. It's like, oh, this famous non-Canadian person was in Canada when they did a thing.
I think my favorite one was like Edison Bell, who is claimed by every possible country that could.
Or Winnie the Pooh. That one is like ludicrous.
Okay. This isn't what this episode's about.
So appeal factors for pulp.
It's candy. Yeah, it's fun to read. It can be fun sometimes to read stories that like aren't trying to tell anything deeper, that are just like, it's a, you know, rip-roaring, rollicking, ridiculous, other R words, good time.
And at this point, for some of the ones that are actually from the era in which they were the pulp, mm-hmm. like, stories, it's sort of a fascinating trip into a historical aspect of, you know, what was popular culture and popular reading at a certain time. And there's a lot of references to like, what were the concerns and interests and motivations of the time? How were things shared? What were tropes like? What was imagery was interesting? What kind of language was used? Like all of that is sort of fascinating to explore.
I'm sure you could also like, you know, draw a line between like the radio shows, the movie serials into like TV shows into like, I don't know, like, I have no idea what's on television anymore, but like 24 is probably like pulp fiction in many ways. That's an old show now, but like that's kind of seems like it fits into this area.
It's also like they are meant to be broadly read, so they're quite approachable. So it is a way to do that kind of exploration if you aren't a super literary history person who like can analyze things in a deep way, but you still want to get that taste of it. Like this is a way to get that taste without having to be an academic to get into there.
A lot of it would be a lot more approachable if there was less like blatant racism and stuff in it, though. Like it's hard sometimes.
yeah, definitely 100%. A lot of these are really shitty in how they treat members of marginalized communities.
Yep.
If you're not a straight white man, you're often treated second class at best.
They certainly have a voice that is like in the stories that I read, just this celebration of a very certain kind of understanding of the world and perspective on how to be in the world and what was good and what was right in the world that is just so very limited and specific. And it excludes so many people's understanding and experiences of the world. And it gets real tiring real fast.
So, on that note, please go and download my zines. Link in the show notes.
No, and also, like you said about the other magazine that you got in or thinking of getting a subscription to, there are probably other examples of pulp type stories being published in the present day, just not using that label.
Yeah, like the magazine I bought, like, it says it's inspired by pulp, but also, like, is trying to be more literary than pulp. And I feel the stories within that collection kind of represented that.
Fair enough. I think one of the things I really liked about pulp is the sense of anything could happen.
And everything keeps happening. Like, there's not, like, dead zones for the most part in here. Like, it just clips along.
So yeah, what it says is, while we genuinely love the bold, kitschy, experimental early days of these publications, we also recognize that the genre has come a long way since then. So,
support science fiction magazines. A PSA for me, a science fiction writer.
Yeah, honestly, Jam, you should probably look at this as something to write something for. They do open calls for submission. So, one to keep on your radar.
I mean, I got approached. I got approached once to contribute to a pulp themed issue of a magazine, and I don't know that I am a pulp writer. I write science fiction, but it's usually like about people with feelings.
Space and feelings.
Like lasers aren't a feeling.
Yeah, the feelings were pretty limited in the stories that I read. There's an awful lot of pride and, like, discussions essentially of, like, one of them was about in first contact with aliens, and there's this whole aspect of it that's about, well, they were so daring, they made a dash to defend themselves against us. Like, they were aggressors when they had no weaponry whatsoever. And it's such a daring thing to do, and we respect them so much for their daring do on that, right? And that's like, okay. Like, I get it. It's fascinating. But, like, that's the kind of emotion is this, like, very quick, short layer sort of.
Yeah, you've got to respect your cunning enemy.
Yeah.
And then kill them.
Respect and power and pain and, like.
Lust.
But they're quick flash emotions in a lot of instances. Not universally. James sounds like there was a lot of painful exploration of, like, really.
Yeah.
Dramatic situations, but, like.
And, yeah, I think, like, new pulp can address that stuff and discuss that stuff. So it's not like you can't do it within the pulp area. Will we read this again? Yes. Will I write this again? Yes.
Yeah. I feel like I might dip back into the anthology I checked out that had the Lee Brackett story in it. Probably won't just do like a roulette style reading a random pulp. Probably more targeted than that because of the sexism and the racism.
Maybe conceivably, I'm not averse to it. I do find it sort of interesting to kind of from that like perspective of what was. Personally, to me, that's the kind of fascinating aspect of it, but I'm not particularly drawn to the storytelling style, so it's not my, like, first pick.
I only got you to write for one issue of Two Fisted Library Stories.
Yeah, I know. It wasn't a very good story either.
I think it's good. I liked it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Book Club for Masochists. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, subscribe so you never miss an episode, and consider giving us a positive rating and or review. And if you've already done that, thank you.
For all of our URLs and social media accounts, the 4 in our name is a numeral. You can go to our website at bookclub4m.com, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/bookclub4m, and find us on Instagram at bookclub4m. Our email address is bookclub4m@gmail.com.
On our website, you can find show notes that will provide links to the things we mentioned, social media info for everyone who appeared on this episode, and our genre-based book lists of titles by authors of color.
You can suggest a genre or title for us to read or request a recommendation from us. We have a form you can fill out on our website. No promises in reading your suggestion, but we will give you a recommendation.
All opinions are our own and do not reflect our places of employment, if they exist.
Our theme music is To Arrakis by Dark Sun from the Free Music Archive.
New episodes are usually the first and third Tuesday of every month.
Join us again on Tuesday, August 22nd, the fourth Tuesday of the month, when we'll be talking about books and other media we've recently enjoyed.
Then on Tuesday, September 5th, we'll be discussing the format of lyric poetry.
Sorry, one of my cats is being loud and I don't know what he's doing. Oh, he's using the litter box. Cool. Oh, good. I was still recording too much.